Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 10th of August, these are our main stories. Ukraine has told vulnerable people in an area close to Russian front lines to leave immediately because of an increase in Russian attacks. The leaders of the coup in Niger announce a new government as West African countries consider military intervention. And an Ecuadorian presidential candidate is assassinated just 2 weeks before the polls open. Also in this podcast...
I understand that they want to put him away for life. That's hard for me.
Why people in Russia say they're living in fear as former Wagner troops return home. The Ukrainian authorities have issued a mandatory evacuation order around the city of Kupiansk and surrounding areas in the Kharkiv region due to what they say is intense Russian shelling. Earlier, a Russian Defense Ministry spokesman, Igor Konashenkov, claimed successes in the region.
In the Kupiansk region, assault troops have made advances along the front line during offensive operations. During the day, counterattacks by the armed forces of Ukraine were successfully repelled in the Luhansk People's Republic and in the Kharkiv region.
Ukraine's military said the situation around Kupiansk was difficult but under control. Kupiansk was one of several cities and towns in Ukraine recaptured last September. In recent weeks, Russia has been trying to take the cities and towns again. Our correspondent Hugo Bashega is just back from Ukraine and told me more.
It's interesting because over the last few weeks and months, we've been talking about the counteroffensive in the east of the country, in Donetsk, also in the Zaporizhia region of Ukraine. But this is happening in the northeast of the country, so perhaps far away from those areas where the Ukrainians are trying to make some gains. This is happening in the Kharkiv region. And the Ukrainians are saying that this is now the main direction of the Russian offensive. So they're trying to make some gains there in the Kupiansk region. Of Ukraine. And now we're having this announcement of a mandatory evacuation in 37 settlements in this part of the country. And what we're seeing is that we've seen reports in recent days suggesting the fighting has intensified in this area. And I think today the message from the local authorities making this announcement said that Russia has been shelling this area for almost every day, and they're trying to advance in this direction. And I think what is interesting is that the deputy defense minister in Ukraine earlier this week said that Russian forces had formed a large group that is now attempting to break through Ukrainian defenses in that part of the country, and people talking about tens of thousands of Russian forces now in that part of the country.
Something we're going to hear more about, I suspect. Also, Ukraine's Navy wants a humanitarian corridor to get its ships out of ports where they've been trapped for a long time now, back into the Black Sea. How will that work?
That's a very good question. So the announcement was made today by the Ukrainian authorities that this humanitarian corridor is going to be created to let dozens of ships that are now trapped in Ukrainian ports to sail into the Black Sea. Obviously, this is perhaps, you know, the way that the Ukrainians have come up with to let these ships sail into the Black Sea after the collapse of the grain deal. So we don't know how this is going to work. We haven't had any kind of reaction from Moscow. Obviously, Russia has been saying that any ship could be considered a military target in that part of the world. What the Ukrainians are saying is that they're going to put cameras on the ships to show that this is a humanitarian mission with no military purpose, but we don't know how this is going to work.
Hugo Bashega, who's just back from Ukraine. 2 weeks after the coup that toppled Niger's president, Mohamed Bazoum, the regional grouping of West African countries, ECOWAS, hasn't yet said how it intends to resolve the crisis. Today, ECOWAS leaders are meeting in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, to talk about whether to seek a diplomatic solution or take military action. There's also been concern expressed by the US, France and the UN Secretary General about the health of the former president who's being held by the coup leaders. Our Africa editor Andrew Harding told me more about the divide within ECOWAS.
Sierra Leone, Guinea-Bissau, Burundi, Senegal, key players in an organization, a grouping that had at some stage been able to intervene militarily in a number of countries. But these days it's a lot more complicated, and it's, I think, far from clear whether their initial threats to use military force in Niger to restore democracy can be followed through. It couldn't happen without Nigeria's endorsement. And right now, Nigeria has problems of its own, priorities of its own. And there is a sense, I think, a growing sense that people in Nigeria and in other countries want to give negotiations, diplomacy and economic sanctions a bit more of a chance to work, to see if they can cut some sort of deal with the coup leaders in Niger to edge them towards some sort of promise of a transition.
Certainly no sign thus far, 2 weeks into this coup, that the military are going to stand down. They've even announced a new cabinet today.
That's right. Very much forging ahead, if you like. And clearly the timing meant to send that message to these regional leaders meeting across the border. They've also perhaps been turning up the screws by continuing to keep the president. You mentioned President Bazoum, who's in essentially being held hostage at his presidential compound in Niamey, in Niger's capital, and growing reports of concern from the Americans and others about the conditions in which the president and his family are being kept. And concerns, too, about the possibility, at least in the future at some point, that Russia might try to exploit this period of instability by sending in Wagner mercenaries, as they've done with some success in neighbouring Mali and elsewhere.
Our Africa editor, Andrew Harding. The Ecuadorian president, Guillermo Lasso, has said the country's presidential election will go ahead as planned this month after a candidate was shot dead at an event in the capital, Quito. Fernando Villavicencio was killed in a burst of gunfire as he was getting into his car. A state of emergency is now in force. Mr. Villavicencio's friend, Dr. Carlos Figueroa, described how he found out about the death.
I was assisting two patients that arrived injured. I thought Fernando made it out. But when I went to the clinic to help injured patients, I entered the emergency room and I saw Fernando was dead. He didn't have vital signs.
Our Latin America editor is Vanessa Buschluter.
Carlos, from whom we've just been hearing there, described the scene of the murder. He and Fernando Villavicencio left a campaign event at 6:20 in the afternoon in the capital, Quito. This campaign event in the centre of Quito, in the financial district, held at a previous, or at a building that had been a school previously, had run very well. He'd shaken hands with voters, and 30 seconds after he left the building, there was a hail of bullets. Fernando Villavicencio received 3 bullets to the head and died. And 9 people were also injured in this horrific attack.
Have we any idea who might be behind this?
Yes, a gang calling themselves Los Lobos, the Wolves, has claimed responsibility for this killing. They released a video in which they wave around their rifles and threaten other politicians. This is a surprising development because I think most people in Ecuador, and including myself, had thought that a different gang called Los Choneros was behind this killing, because Los Choneros had threatened Fernando Villavicencio just last week. They had threatened his life, and Fernando Villavicencio had been giving a security detail, but that security detail was not able to save his life when he was attacked last night.
And in terms of the state of emergency, what does that mean for the conduct of the election that obviously is ongoing?
There were some voices in Ecuador which questioned whether the election maybe should be put on hold or delayed, but it is going ahead. And many are actually quoting Fernando Villavicencio himself, who said just weeks ago, when a different politician, a local mayor, was killed, he said that people should not be cowed, that democracy should continue. So I think in his honour, the elections will go ahead. And of course, it is a, you know, important exercise in democracy to hold this presidential election.
Our Latin America editor, Vanessa Buschluter. In Hawaii, the number of deaths resulting from wildfires on Maui Island has risen to 36. The worst affected area is the popular resort city of Lahaina, which has been almost totally burnt to the ground. Mason Jarvi, who suffered burns fleeing the fire in Lahaina, said the situation there was devastating.
I'm a resident of Lahaina for about 18 years, and we just had the worst disaster I've ever seen. All Lahaina is burnt to a crisp, and it's like an apocalypse.
Over 2,000 people have been displaced and moved to special shelters or hotels. Bob Fenton of the Federal Emergency Management Agency urged people to be cautious.
There's still fire going on. Life's being saved. So please follow your local officials, listen to their message, and make sure you're safe. Make sure you have a plan. Make sure that if you have questions, you're working with your local officials.
To find out more, I spoke to CBS correspondent Jared Hill.
One of the things, Andrew, that we know here is that because of the conditions on the ground, it had been difficult for officials really to get through a significant portion of the island of Maui to be able to tell exactly who was unaccounted for because they were sheltering in a car or a hotel without access to a phone to tell people, or if they had in fact died. And while we don't know the circumstances around any of these deaths at this point, again, it does appear that as they're able to get more onto the island, they're learning more about just the level of destruction here.
What do we know about what's happening in Hawaii now? It's nighttime on the islands, of course, and the authorities continue to do their work in the wake of what's happened.
Yeah, so there are kind of two things that are happening here. One, there are the efforts to continue putting out these fires, which had been raging really on that island for hours there. So there's the fire suppression effort, but then there is also this search and rescue mission that is continuing to happen, again, trying to see where people might be and get folks to safety. There's also an effort here to make sure that the people who have been able to evacuate the island of Maui have somewhere to go. There are shelters that have been set up on some of the neighboring islands. There are also efforts to get people on planes to be able to fly out so that they can worry as little as possible about people that might be on the island and just try and focus on getting the fire out and making sure that it's safe for anyone to return at a later date.
And the last thing we need is more communities affected. What's the weather forecast in terms of controlling the fire versus the possibility of more fires breaking out or spreading?
Right. So the winds have died down significantly from the peak of this. Remember, this is all related largely to a hurricane that didn't actually touch the island of Maui, but the winds helped to fuel some of these flames. Those winds have died down, which have allowed for the crews there to continue with their fire suppression, getting helicopters in the air to douse some of these fires with water. That'll continue for as long as it takes.
CBS correspondent Jared Hill. The Wagner Group of Russian mercenaries has now ended its deployment in Ukraine, and that means many of the fighters it recruited from prisons, including murderers, are now free. But as Arseniy Sokolov reports, not everyone is ready to welcome them.
A village hall in southern Russia. A young woman in a crazily patterned pink and blue jumpsuit with waist-length brown hair is dancing with a group of excited children. Organizing parties and games for young people is 19-year-old Tatiana Mastika's first job, and she loves it. But hours after one event like this, back in April, Tatiana was murdered by a gang whose alleged ringleader should have been safely behind bars, serving time for another murder. But he had been let out years early to fight in Ukraine, let out and pardoned. Thanks to this man, Yevgeny Prigozhin, founder of the mercenary company Wagner. He taught prisons to recruit tens of thousands of convicted murderers, rapists, and robbers. They were used to kill Ukrainians in the bloodiest battles of the war. And many of them lost their lives too. But those who survived have now left Wagner and are walking the streets of Russia again. And in some cases, already committing new crimes.
How could you raise your hand against a child? Someone who wasn't threatening you in any way. A child who had just started to leave, for whom all doors were open.
That's Nadezhda Pleshkova, the mother of the children's entertainer Tatiana Mastika. Tatiana's body and that of her boss, Kirill Chupko, were found buried in woodland in the Krasnodar region in early May. Three suspects have been arrested in connection with the killing. One of them, Demyan Kivarkyan, who denies any wrongdoing, had already been serving an 18-year sentence for crimes including murder. But he was released after only 6 years to fight in Ukraine. Then, like other criminal recruits, he was free to go home with a pardon.
Let me draw your attention to the word pardon. That's not the same as amnesty.
Olga Romanova is the founder of Russia Behind Bars, an organization campaigning for prison reform.
A pardon is given to an individual personally by the president himself. And the law says it comes after reconciliation with a victim and a good report from prison. None of this happens when Wagner criminals are pardoned. But even so, they can restart their lives with a clean slate.
Indeed, they are officially regarded as heroes. At least 20 serious crimes by former Wagner convicts have been reported. Murders, rapes, grievous bodily harm. But the real number may be greater, because it's now illegal in Russia to discredit anyone involved in what's officially called the special military operation. That law could, in theory, even be used against the police themselves. Large numbers of mourners attended the funerals of the children's entertainers Kirill Chupko and Tatiana Mastika. And since then, tens of thousands of people in Krasnodar have signed a petition to demand that the chief suspect, Demyan Kivarkyan, gets a life sentence if he is convicted of the murders. But Tatiana's mother, Nadezhda, doesn't think it will have much effect.
Of course, I understand who was responsible for my daughter's death. And I know he had a previous conviction. I'm not stupid. I understand that they won't put him away for life. But that's hard for me. Sorry.
In today's Russia, she thinks, the victims of so-called heroes can't expect real justice.
Arseny Sokolov reporting. Still to come in this podcast, an announcement for Taylor Swift fans as the US dates on her record-breaking tour come to an end. In the US, a man who made violent threats against President Biden has been shot dead by the FBI in Utah. The shooting happened while agents were attempting to serve him with an arrest warrant just hours before Mr. Biden's planned visit to the state. Our correspondent in Washington is Nomia Iqbal.
The suspect's name was Craig Robertson. We understand he was 75 years old. And there was a criminal complaint that had already been filed in the District Court of Utah regarding serious concerns about him. So one of the charges that he was facing was threats against the president. I've got the criminal complaint in front of me. But FBI agents conducted a surveillance of his home back in March. They wanted to talk to him about his social media posts. He told them, according to the complaint, to come back with an arrest warrant, which they did. Now, when you look at the criminal complaint and the evidence that they had compiled against him, it included social media posts that he'd put up, and they're very dark messages. They show violence towards President Biden and other notable Democrats, also glorifying guns. One particular post which worried agents and that has been cited in the criminal complaint is when he posted, "I hear Biden is coming to Utah, cleaning the dust off the M24 sniper rifle. Welcome, buffoon in chief." Now, we haven't been given any details on exactly what led to the shooting, although our partner station CBS says law enforcement sources told them that there was a gunfire of some sort. And the FBI told the BBC in a statement that they're following their policy, which is to now refer the case to the agency for a review.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. The World Bank has suspended new loans to Uganda in the wake of a tough new law against same-sex relations. There's already been a negative reaction on the markets, with the Ugandan shilling weakening sharply after the announcement. My colleague Davina Gupta spoke to Fabrice Odar, an advisor with Open for Business, a coalition of leading global companies dedicated to LGBT inclusion, formerly of the World Bank. He explains how significant this decision is for Uganda.
The budget of the Ugandan government is very reliant on external aid. And in fact, the budget of the government is about $13 or $14 billion. And you could say that $1 billion usually comes from the World Bank. But there's another aspect to it, which is that the budget of the Ugandan government is also dependent on borrowing from various sources.
Is this sort of intervention by the World Bank enough for the government in Uganda to reconsider their decision?
On the side of the World Bank, the objective is not so much for the Ugandan government to reconsider the Anti-Homosexuality Act. It is to say, well, look, it's impossible for us to have effective development project if you intentionally bar an entire segment of your population from benefiting from development efforts.
But in effect, then, a lot of questions have been asked, and especially by our listeners as well, whether this sort of ends up being counterproductive and hurting locals in Uganda.
That's a very legitimate question, right? Which is, ultimately, the poorest in Uganda are the victims of the political manipulation of LGBTQ plus people by President Museveni. But ultimately, the World Bank, if it wants to respect its policies, cannot lend to Uganda if Uganda refuses to acknowledge that there are LGBTQ plus people that are deserving of development efforts in the country. And, you know, one of the things that I said today is that the World Bank would have done the same thing if we were talking about other underrepresented minorities. Like if there was a similar piece of legislation on Dalit people in India or Batwa people in Congo or Roma people in Europe, the World Bank would have been in the same situation in having to say, well, look, we cannot continue to have new lending activities until you have solved this problem.
Fabrice Odart. In other LGBT news today, Iraqi authorities have ordered media outlets, when referring to the topic, to refer to homosexual acts as sexual deviance and to also avoid using the term gender in broadcasts or publications. A government spokesman said the order still requires final approval and that a penalty for violating the rule hadn't yet been set but could include a fine. Dylan Sirwan is a journalist in Iraq.
Well, let's not forget that this is only a resolution. It's not necessarily a law. Therefore, it cannot be like put into the law and imposed on these people. However, there are very dangerous implications of such resolutions because the community is already suffering from a lot. They are already being persecuted for being who they are. And this will, in the long term, may cause even more harmful implications because this will cause what is already a culture, a society that does not accept these people, will just cause them to antagonize against the community even more. It's not set yet how the order is going to be carried out, whether there will be, I don't know, people will be arrested or they will be fined for this. But even if there is a payment or a fine regarding the use of the word homosexuality or even gender for that matter, it's going to be very bad for journalists that are covering such stories and covering the lives of the LGBT community.
Dylan Sirwan in Iraq. Australia's National Science Agency and Boeing have announced plans to develop sustainable domestic jet fuel. Aircraft will be powered by renewable sources, and that could significantly cut carbon emissions. From Sydney, our correspondent, Phil Mercer.
Researchers say that Australia has enough agricultural waste, animal fats and vegetable oils to make almost 5 billion litres of sustainable aviation fuel by 2025. A Boeing 747 Jumbo carries about 240,000 litres of fuel. By changing the molecular structure of waste products, using a range of different pressures and temperatures, and sometimes adding hydrogen, scientists believe they can create a fuel that's almost identical to its traditional kerosene cousin. Max Temminghoff is from the CSIRO, Australia's National Science Agency.
Sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF for short, is a safe replacement for fossil-derived conventional jet fuel. Instead of being produced from crude oil, it's generated from non-fossil raw materials or feedstocks. And the beauty of that is that it provides a net reduction in CO2 emissions when compared to its fossil-derived equivalent. SAF costs up to 2 to 4 times as much as conventional jet fuel.
Apart from costs, various other challenges must be overcome in Australia. They include guaranteeing the supply of raw materials and conforming to international regulations. The International Energy Agency has said that aviation accounts for about 2% of global CO2 emissions, but it's one of the most challenging sectors to decarbonize. The IEA has also asserted that planned production of sustainable aviation fuels would satisfy just a small fraction of demand by 2027. Qantas, Australia's national carrier, wants 10% of its fuel to come from sustainable sources by the end of the decade.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. It was the final date of Taylor Swift's record-breaking tour at the Sophie Stadium in Los Angeles. Fans had an idea something special might happen, some kind of announcement. They were right. A new album called 1989, Taylor's Version, is on the way in a couple of months, in October. Iona Hampson is here with more. So just explain to us what the Taylor's Version of each album is.
Yes, so Taylor Swift has been on a personal mission for the last couple of years to re-release her first six studio albums. The reason for this is that in 2019, she came in a dispute with her former record label, Big Machine Records, the founder and the new owner, who wanted to sell all of her six albums that they owned, their masters of, to a private equity company. It's estimated this was sold for about $300 million. Taylor Swift was not happy about this. Because they were the masters, they could control things like the licensing of the song, so whether it's used in an advert or a film, for instance. So what she's been doing is re-releasing these songs, which are almost covers of her songs in that sort of technical way.
They're stripped back a bit.
Absolutely.
A little bit more acoustic.
For sure. So what sort of the differences are, of course, her sound is a bit more mature, her voice is mature, but there are slight differences in the production, some of the lyrics. So there are differences, and you find that with Taylor Swift fans, they would much rather listen to the Taylor Swift versions, the Taylor versions of it, rather than the originals.
Okay. Now, the announcement on the 9th of August had been expected because she drops hints. They're all to do with numbers, I think, the hints, aren't they? About
yes.
What date something's going to happen, that kind of thing.
Taylor Swift loves to give clues to her fans, and her fans love to try and understand them, whether they're in her music videos or on social media. With this social media post that she released today, she was talking about how 1989 is one of her favourite re-records. There'll be five new unreleased tracks, which she says are some of the best that she can't even believe they were ever left behind. So this will be really exciting for Taylor Swift fans.
And this comes at the end of the North America section of her Eras tour, which has broken all kinds of records and even caused earth tremors in Canada a few days ago.
That's correct. This is a huge tour, 44 songs that are divided into 10 acts, 3 hours long. So it is a marathon to get through. And what's amazing about this is that the Eras tour is expected to be the highest grossing tour of all time, which is expected to have $1 billion in sales. This even surpasses Elton John's record, his Farewell Yellow Brick Road tour. So this just shows how big this achievement is.
Lots of talk about Taylor Swift online today. Thanks, Iona. And that's all from us for now. Before we go, though, clarification of an item we carried in the last edition of the Global News podcast about the death of the musician Sisto Rodriguez. We inadvertently suggested that he was popular in South Africa among young black people protesting against apartheid. However, a number of listeners have been in touch to say his popularity was predominantly among white South Africans, and we say thank you to those of you who pointed that out to us. Thank you. If you'd like to get in touch about anything in this podcast and the stories we included, drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You'll find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chris Lovelock. The producer was Iona Hampson. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening, and until next time. Goodbye.
World Football at the Women's World Cup is the podcast telling the global story of the tournament.
I'm so proud of our team, of our girls.
We're speaking to the fans who have travelled down under as they share all the excitement of this incredible competition.
I think we're still in the running to go all the way.
I'm really, really proud of Vietnamese.
This is probably the biggest moment in their careers, and Australia's right behind them.
World Football at the Women's World Cup from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.